And we're back, Prescott. It is a beautiful Wednesday morning in everybody's hometown, Prescott, Arizona. And it, as is our habit on the second Wednesday of the month, we're visiting with Dr. Cal from the Cornwall Alliance and the Stewardship for Creation. And we are going to be talking about all things to do with climate. And we're going to be talking about it from a very specific perspective. And that is the perspective of, is the study of the climate, in fact, settled science? And is what you hear in the mainstream media, in fact, correct? Or is it grossly slanted? So without further ado, let's say good morning to Dr. Cal. Cal, how are you today?
Very fine, Terry. Thanks much for having me back on the program. And I will enjoy this conversation because, frankly, the integrity of science is one of my major concerns. Science has been a tremendous boon to Western civilization and indeed to all of mankind for hundreds of years. But unfortunately, the bogus science behind climate alarmism is setting the whole scientific enterprise in serious question as people begin to see more and more the hype substituting for real science, and then they begin to lose their trust in real science.
One of the things that I think you can track fairly efficiently and fairly dramatically is the extent to which the proclamations over the last 50 years of the alarmists have been wrong, wrong, wrong. The 98 models of the IPCC are 2A1. Every one of the 98 models are wrong. They all systematically overestimate. As a statistician, if you had a group of models that assigned parameters at random, you'd expect half of them, 46 to overestimate, 46 to underestimate. And as a statistician, when I look at the models, and all 92 or all 98, depending on which count you want to take, every one of them overestimate global mean temperature, a red flag comes up, and you go, wait, something's wrong. But what's most alarming to me is that this leads people, it gives the average consumer of science information permission to then wander off the reservation, so to speak, on issues like inoculation. And you can track the extent to which people embrace the idea that CO2 is, quote-unquote, causing global climate change to issues like, I'm not going to inoculate my children against mumps, measles, and rubella. And you see people doing things that are clearly irrational that science, quote-unquote, science tells them not to do, because they start to see that they're being systematically misled by the mainstream media and by big science. And I think it is a horrible, horrible situation, and it causes people to do absolutely dysfunctional things, both for themselves individually, for their children, and for society.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, and it's a tremendous concern of ours at the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. This is why a few years back we asked one of our fellows, a professor of biology at Geneva College in Pennsylvania, to write a special article for us called What's Incredible? And the article gives readers a number of criteria to use to judge the scientific credibility of articles that they see, whether those articles are in popular magazines like Psychology Today or Time or Newsweek or something of that sort, or in scientific journals. Because, frankly, the standards for publication, even in scientific journals, have declined significantly, so that, for instance, quite recently, Daniel Sarewitz, University of Arizona, and a major, major scientific figure, published a lengthy editorial in, I think it was Nature, at the moment I don't remember for sure, but a lengthy editorial in which he bemoaned the fact that so much of what gets published as science anymore is just factually wrong, and in many instances should have been obviously factually wrong to the editors of the journals where it has appeared. The frequency with which journal articles are being retracted is way up. The non-replicability of studies is way up. And, you know, Terry, you know, that is an absolutely crucial factor for scientific work. When somebody says, you know, I did this study and these are the results I got, anybody else should be able to perform the same steps and get the same results. And that, again and again, is turning out to be not possible with many studies that are being published. So, in our article, What's Incredible, we explain the criteria so that lay readers, people like you and me who are not, well, I'm not a scientist, though I read voluminously in the field, we then can read these articles and have a rational basis for assessing how credible they are.
And I think it's very, very important for folks to, and again, folks, the duty, with the common law provision is with notice goes duty. One of the things that Dr. Cal and the Cornwall Alliance are doing is they're putting you on notice that the folks in the white lab coats that you had blind trust in for the first 5 or 6 decades of the 20th century are no longer, and I think it would be fair to argue if they ever were, they certainly are no longer to be blindly trusted as telling you the absolute truth, or as it used to be said in Perry Mason, the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God. It's up to you to exercise due diligence and ask yourself, in a prima facie, on its face, does this seem reasonable? And to become educated and to explore the data and ask yourself, does this seem reasonable? And I really feel that it is the duty of every informed citizen to get involved in these discussions. And I can remember being 10 years old and being in the airport in Denver, Colorado, and my dad walked me across the airport to shake hands with Dr. Salk and Sabin, and he said, these men saved your life. And, you know, in our household, it was discussed all the time that polio was a killer and that there were these great men of science who were trying to save our lives. And my father,
same with me.
Right. And my father saw them in the airport, walked me across as a little boy and said, I want you to shake their hands. I want you to tell them they saved your life. And I can't, if I wanted to walk my adult children, my son's 37, my daughter's 19, if I wanted to walk them through an airport right now and grab a scientist, I don't know who. Well, my personal favorites, I could do that with Dr. Christie, I suppose, but there'd be very few people that I could walk up to at this point in modern American science and say, you're saving people's lives. And that is a deplorable statement about the overall state of scientific inquiry at this point in 2016, but it's a true state. And the thing is that anyone who is serious about science, and, you know, just like the article you're alluding to, What is Wrong with Scientific Publishing and How to Fix It, if you look seriously at what's going on, there's been an explosion of scientific journals. 40 years ago, there were 1/20th the journals there are now, and there is no possible way to police, and I mean that in both the capital P and the lowercase p sense. There's no way to police the journals or the publications. And we joked in my doctoral studies, we joked about the $100 bill test. If you'd place a $100 bill at the midpoint of your dissertation before it was placed in the library at your university and come back 20 years later, would the $100 bill still be there? And we all, you know, pretty much all of us did that. And I can tell you, mine's still there. No one's opened up my dissertation. And I can't imagine.
Where is that, by the way? Go there.
I'll just send 100 to the Cornwall Alliance. You don't have to visit.
You
don't have to visit that dusty library. But, you know, that was one of the standing jokes among all the people who were pursuing a PhD with me, that very few people were going to read it. And among the folks who earned their PhDs in management, we all joked that the preeminent journals in our area, the Academy of Management Review and the Academy of Management Journal, the publication rate was about 4% in those journals. And globally, if 10, 20 people read a particular article, that was a big deal. And yeah. There was no mass audience for it, and it really didn't ever get out there. So that is an environment that is just begging for plagiarism and certain falsehoods to occur, and then we're stunned. We act just shocked when it does.
Yeah, and yet it has become extremely common. And let me pick up on your reference to Dr. Christie. That's Dr. John Christie. He is a principal research scientist in climatology at the University of Alabama, partner with and actually supervisor to Dr. Roy Spencer, also there at the University of Alabama. And those two are in charge of NASA's satellite program by which we get 24/7, 365, all latitudes, all longitudes, all altitudes monitoring of global atmospheric temperature. That is the best source that we have for global temperature data. Now, you mentioned scientists, Salk and Sabin, who saved many lives by figuring out the polio vaccine. And I remember taking the polio vaccine back when I was a child. I believe that Drs. Spencer and Christie are doing exactly that, saving people's lives. Dr. Spencer, by the way, is a senior fellow for the Cornwall Alliance and has written frequently for us. And in fact, we just published a booklet of his on explaining the science of climate change and why it doesn't support the notion of dangerous climate change driven by human activity. Well, you know, how are they saving lives? Well, it's this way. The policies promoted to reduce global warming are all policies that would require a huge reduction in energy consumption around the world. They don't say that explicitly. They don't say, oh, we must consume less energy. Instead, what they do is they say, well, it's energy generated from using fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, that causes dangerous global warming. So we need to use less of that kind of energy. Well, the alternative kinds of energy, particularly wind and solar and geothermal, all are much more expensive. Well, anybody who knows, who's taken Econ 101 in college, or for that matter, even just a little bit of Econ in high school, knows that as prices rise, consumption falls. You consume less of stuff that is more expensive than of stuff that is less expensive. And so, as energy consumption falls, all the things that are served by that energy consumption have to fall as well. Well, energy consumption, it turns out, is absolutely essential to everything that we depend on: food, clothing, shelter, transportation, health care, communications. Everything that we do requires energy. And so as energy consumption falls, the benefits of all of those things decline, which means that we wind up with more disease, with more hunger, more malnutrition, all sorts of things of that sort, and less safe housing. And the result is more sickness, earlier death for human beings. So Drs. Spencer and Christie are providing the information, the really sound scientific information, that undercuts the claims of dangerous warming driven by human emissions of CO2. How do they do that? Well, the satellite measurements of temperature around the world show clearly that the warming that has occurred over the relevant period has been at most half as much, more likely a third to a quarter as much, as the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and various other alarmist organizations say should have happened based on their understanding of CO2's impact on temperature. That means that CO2 doesn't warm the Earth nearly so much as is claimed. And that, in turn, means that we don't need to worry about dangerous impacts of that warming, and therefore we don't need to reduce our energy consumption, and therefore we don't need to reduce our use of fossil fuels, which means we can afford more energy, and that energy can lift more people out of poverty. That's a crucial thing, and that's how these two scientists, both of them good friends of mine, and Dr. Spencer, a senior fellow of the Cornwall Alliance, are doing exactly what you said, saving human lives.
And that's a perfect point to take our first break for the day. We're going to take a quick break, sell a few products. Folks, if you'd like to call in with a question or a comment, 541-1016, or if you're on the World Wide Web, 928-541-1016. When we get back, we're going to dig further into this. So quick break, and we'll be right back with Dr. Cal. And we're back, Prescott, to the dulcet tones of Jimmy Buffett. And we've got Dr. Cal on the line from the Cornwall Alliance. Now, folks, if you go to the website for Cornwall Alliance, and this is all lowercase, just like it sounds, Cornwall, C-O-R-N-W-A-L-L-A, Alliance, cornwallalliance.org, you will be given a whole set of resources. There's all kinds of information there. Now, you folks also have prepared several videos for the folks who would rather watch than read. And why don't we discuss some of the video information that you have available on the website and some of the information that folks can download or purchase from you?
Yeah. Well, thanks. We started on that with a set of videos called Resisting the Green Dragon. These are 12 lectures by 9 different scholars, scientists, economists, theologians, historians, philosophers, a fascinating group lecturing on the anti-Christian worldview, theology, and ethics, the poor science, the poor economics of the environmental movement as a whole. You know, there are exceptions to that, but as a whole, that's the way the movement is, and showing how a Judeo-Christian biblical worldview and sound science and sound economics really support a non-alarmist understanding of how humanity relates to the world. Environmentalism typically assumes that human beings are basically consumers and polluters, using up the world's resources and poisoning it while we're at it. A biblical worldview says that human beings made in God's image are capable of producing more than we consume and of actually improving the state of the planet. We put it at the Cornwall Alliance, exercising godly dominion. That is, men and women made in God's image working lovingly together to enhance the fruitfulness, the beauty, and the safety of the earth to the glory of God and the benefit of our neighbors. So we're addressing the two great commandments, to love God and to love neighbor. So that series is available on 4 DVDs that even has with it a printable discussion guide, leaders' discussion guide. So it actually is a curriculum in a box for a Sunday school quarter, for a quarter at a private Christian school or a home school, things of that sort. Tremendous value in that. That's Resisting the Green Dragon. That's on our website, or people can see about it at resistingthegreendragon.com. We also offer a video called Blue. This is sort of an alternative to green. The acronym stands for Beautify, Liberate, Utilize, Enjoy. And this is a documentary showing the wrong science and wrong economics of much of the environmental movement, particularly related to climate change, and interviewing a number of scholars around the world. It's a really well done single disc documentary that is available on our website. And then finally, recently we published a new documentary called Where the Grass is Greener: Biblical Stewardship versus Climate Alarmism. And in this, we've interviewed over 30 world-class scholars on the science, the economics, the ethics, the politics of climate change and climate and energy policy. And we provide their really sound basis for recognizing that whereas human activity probably does influence global average temperature, the amount to which it does, the extent to which it does, is very, very slight, probably, in fact, immeasurably small. We can calculate it theoretically, but I don't think that it's big enough to get outside the margin of error for global temperature measurement. But the activities that contribute to that warming are themselves tremendously important to human well-being, particularly the generation of energy from fossil fuels. No society has ever climbed out of poverty or can stay out of poverty without abundant, affordable, reliable energy. And aside from nuclear, the best source we have for that kind of energy is fossil fuels. And in fact, for transportation fuels particularly, even nuclear can't compete because you need immense amounts of energy in a small volume and in light weight. And that can be provided for vehicles moving across vast distances best through the liquid fuels that we get from oil and natural gas rather than from electricity.
And it's critically important to realize how much of modern life is dependent upon fossil fuel. I find it amazing when I listen to my freshman students lecture me about how evil fossil fuels are when they're wearing fossil fuels, driving fossil fuel vehicles, and surviving because of fossil fuels. We have a hard break
for texting and posting their social media messages,
right.
Using phones that depend on electricity that comes from fossil fuels.
Exactly. I got to take a hard break for news here at the bottom of the hour. Sell a few more products. Dr. Cal, hang on. We'll be right back with more. Quick break for news, folks. We'll be right back. And we're back, Prescott, and it's the second Wednesday of the month, and on the second Wednesday of the month, we're going to talk science, and we're going to talk science specifically through the lens of global climate change and the allegation that CO2 is causing dangerous climate change, and that is an allegation that I reject. I think science rejects it. I think if you believe in the scientific methodology, and I think if you believe in the scientific and statistical definition of causation, you reject it. And even beyond that, one of the first major folks that convinced me beyond a doubt that the science of global warming, so-called global warming, was just dead wrong, was the former co-founder of Greenpeace, Dr. Patrick Moore. And you longtime listeners to the show will remember we've had Dr. Moore on the show. When the co-founder of Greenpeace comes out and says the global warming movement is not just wrong, they're dead wrong, and CO2 is not just not a pollutant, it's plant food and it's necessary to all life on Earth, I think you've got to open your eyes and wake up to the reality that there is something, to quote the great Dane, something's rotten in Denmark.
Yeah, that is certainly so, and Dr. Moore has done invaluable service in uncovering the hypocrisy of the current Greenpeace and many other environmental organizations. Patrick Moore was, as you mentioned, a co-founder of Greenpeace. He was its president for a time. He left it in as early as the mid-1980s, precisely because he saw that it was becoming increasingly a left-wing political organization. Now, keep in mind, Dr. Moore is not himself a political conservative. He's actually fairly left-wing in his understanding of economics and economic policy and the like, but he's a good scientist. He's an honest scientist, and he recognized that Greenpeace's rank-and-file employees, its activists, and so on, were really promoting leftist political causes under the banner of scientific support for environmental disaster claims that simply were not true. So that's why Dr. Moore left that, and he has continued to analyze, to test, and critique the environmental movement ever since. And part of the very valuable stuff he's done on that has been his showing A, that the warming effect of carbon dioxide is not so great as what the activists claim, and B, that it's beneficial effect on plant growth and therefore on agricultural crop yields and therefore on food availability to human beings, especially to the poor, is much, much greater than what the alarmists claim. We can summarize it this way, Terry. For every doubling of atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration, you get an average 35% increase in plant growth efficiency. Plants grow better in warmer and colder temperatures and in wetter and drier soils. They make better use of soil nutrients, they increase their fruit-to-fiber ratio, and they resist diseases and pests better. This means that they expand their ranges instead of getting, instead of being squeezed out, so that you might have extinctions or loss of crops. Instead, crops and all other plants grow in greater and greater areas, and the result is more food for everything that eats plants or eats something that eats plants. And the ones who benefit from that for the most are the poor, who can least afford expensive food. So as food quantities rise, food prices fall, and the food and the poor around the world eat better. It's been estimated that the value of added agricultural crop yields from 1960 to 2012, attributable solely to the CO2 that we added to the atmosphere, is approximately $3.2 trillion. And if we project the increase in CO2 from now to 2050, the added value of crop yield over that period from rising CO2 will be approximately $9.8 trillion. That's a tremendous benefit to mankind.
And especially since it accrues directly. That doesn't have to be that money. That value doesn't have to go through the sticky fingers of the United Nations and through the sticky fingers of corrupt governments in Central Africa or Sub-Saharan Africa. It just accrues a direct benefit to the poorest people on Earth. And if you do the opposite, if you try to restrict CO2, you will engage in a process that the Harvard School of Public Health refers to as engaging in a process of statistical murder. You pursue policies where at the end of the day, more people end up dead than otherwise would have ended up dead, and you spend more money. The cost of the reforms, quote-unquote reforms, that the IPCC suggests would cost over the next 30 years $72 trillion, and it would harm, there would be billions fewer people, and the people who would be there would be sicker, and they would be starving more, they would die more frequently. On every measure of human happiness, health, and prosperity, they would be worse off. And it is just an undeniable truth that this attack on CO2 is an attack on the welfare of the poorest, who tend to be people of color, tend to be female, and tend to be children. The policies of the global warming alarmists are racist and sexist and classist, and they operate as a hammer, as a boot on the neck of the poorest, the weakest, and the least among us. And, I had a friend of mine who's, was giving me the lecture about how if Jesus was alive today, he'd be in the global warming movement. And I said, if Jesus was alive today, he would backhand you because you got your boot on the neck of the poor. You're trying to destroy their ability to have any kind of life. They've got to have access to energy, to have clean water, clean food, and electricity. That's the... you got 3 billion people with no access to electricity. You got 3 billion people with no access to clean water. You've got people by the billions, probably 1.5 billion people, whose number one source of pollution is the fire that they burn inside their house for cooking, where the women and the youngest children are exposed to that pollution every single day. And you got 200, 300 million people a year getting lung disorders from the internal house-centered pollution from burning dung and other things inside their homes. I got
to
take
and
a quick
break. 2 to 4 million of those die every year.
Absolutely. You're engaging in a process of statistical murder by not allowing them to have access to fossil fuels and electricity and a better life. And the idea that you're going to restrict CO2 is a fool's errand. It's an absolute fool's errand. And beyond that, when I see people say, the Pope said this recently, we want to eliminate all carbon. If CO2 falls below 150 parts per million, all plant life dies, which means all life on Earth dies. The most foolish thing, I seriously hope the Pope didn't mean that, because that's a death sentence for every life form on the planet. If you get CO2 below 150 parts per million, you'll kill everything on Earth. But we got to take a quick break here, and we'll be right back with Dr. Cal. Quick break for news. And we're back, folks. And again, I urge you to go to the website for the Cornwall Alliance. And there are some very provocative questions that are asked and discussions that are laid out. I think of the Greek phrase dialogos, which means for meaning to pass through. One of the headings here, five questions to expose climate alarmism. And it starts with Nobel Prize winning physicist Richard Feynman once says, the key to science was realizing if your theory about how the world works yielded predictions contradicted by observations, your theory was wrong. And I really think, you know, Feynman was the greatest physicist of the 20th century. Lots of people say it was Einstein. I personally like Feynman much more, and Feynman's one of my heroes. But Feynman made it very clear that it doesn't matter what your theory says. What matters is what your experiment shows, and what do your observations show. And he made the point over and over again that once you have observable results, they ought to be translatable to the average person. The average person should get it. And that's one of the things that's clearly wrong with the current state of climate science. When the IPCC says, oh, you know, it's going to go up by 2 degrees, 4 degrees, 6 degrees, and it doesn't happen. As a matter of fact, temperatures go down. That should tell us something.
Yeah, it certainly should. And that's precisely what's been happening. Here's a way that the ordinary person can really test the whole claim of dangerous man-made global warming. The 117 different computer models on which the IPCC depends, on average, predicted more than twice, in fact, almost three times the amount of warming actually observed over the entire history of the satellite period, the satellite temperature monitoring period, which is 1979 to the present. Now, that's the best data that we have. So the models predict two to three times as much warming as actually observed over that period, which means that the models are wrong. Further, as you mentioned earlier, 95% of the models predict more warming than actually observed over that period. Now, if their errors were random, as you mentioned, we would see them predicting less warming than actually observed as often as more warming than actually observed. But instead, we see them predicting 95% of the time more warming than observed. That means that the errors are not random. They're driven by some kind of bias. Now, whether that bias is dishonest, you know, we're determined to make the models come up with these conclusions, or honest, we just simply don't understand how the climate system works, and so we put in some parameters that turn out to be mistaken, but we don't know that they're mistaken. Frankly, I don't know which is really driving it, but the errors are driven by this sort of bias. And finally, none of them predicted the complete absence of statistically significant global warming from early 1997 to late 2015, which is a period of almost 18 years and 10 months. That means that the models are invalidated. And if they're invalidated, then they provide no basis, no rational basis whatsoever, for any predictions about future temperature, and therefore also no rational basis for any kind of policy responding to expectations about future temperature. And finally, Terry, the most ironic thing about this is that the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change itself told us in the summary for policymakers of the 2001 assessment report that because the climate system is a coupled, nonlinear, chaotic, fluid system, it is therefore impossible to predict future global climate. And yet, then they spend billions of dollars on their repeated assessment reports trying to predict future climate.
Absolutely. That one quote, I always, whenever I'm asked to speak to a local group, I start with that one quote and I say, don't trust crazy old Dr. Lovell. Here's what the IPCC says. Here's their statement, that the long-term prediction of future climate states is not possible. And, you know, I always say, since this is what they say, we're done. We can go home. There's no reason to pursue this. They don't need our billions. They don't need our tax money. We don't need to put in the curlicue light bulb. We don't need to do any of this stuff. We don't have to do it any further. And, oh, boy, I'll tell you, your young students who have been brainwashed by the K-12 education system, man, do they get upset when you say that. Oh, they don't like that at all.
Yeah. And, you know, you have to wonder, granted that the IPCC knows that basic fact about the physics of climate, why do they still pursue all of this? And I think that the answer really ultimately comes down to money and power. They realize that they can have the kind of power over people's lives, the kind of power to determine whole nations' energy production and distribution systems, and therefore everything about what we do, since everything we do depends on energy. They can have that power only if they can persuade us that our safety depends on our giving them that power. And they can have all the money that comes with that kind of power, all the billions of dollars invested in research on this and invested in trying to devise the different programs, the different policies that are going to deal with it. They can have that only if they persuade us that the danger is real and that we need to be afraid. And the funny thing about this is that back in the 60s and 70s, when the fear was global cooling, we were being told, look, this is being caused by industry that is out of control. This industry needs to be put under control. Us in control. We'll solve the problem.
Right.
Now, they're saying global warming is being caused by industry that's out of control, needs to be put under control, put us in control, we'll solve the problem. The problem is the opposite, but the solution is still put us in control.
Right.
That, I think, is not a great idea.
Freeze or fry, the solution's always the same, put them in charge. Yeah, it doesn't sound quite right. Dr. Cal, we got to take a quick break here, and we'll be right back for our last session. Kurt, hang on. We got a caller we'll get to as soon as we get back. And we're back, folks. It's our last session today. We've been visiting with Dr. Cal Wiesner from the Cornwall Alliance, and we've got Kurt on line two. Let's get to Kurt. He's got a question. Kurt, are you there, buddy?
Yes, I am, sir. Thank you.
You're on the air with Dr. Cal. Ask your question, sir.
All right. Politics. For some reason, what I call the warminess don't like to talk about politics. They say, oh, you're turning it into a political issue. And I keep bringing up that when one single penny of taxpayer dollars is spent on research and pushing the whole issue, it becomes political. And so I know that Maurice Strong, when he established this climate thing with the United Nations, he was intent on making it a political issue. But now the talking point is you can't talk about politics. You have to talk about the science. And so I was wondering if that's by design, to keep people like me who are not scientists from discussing the issue and avoiding the obvious.
Yeah, I think a lot of that does happen. You mentioned Maurice Strong, who was involved in the founding of the United Nations Environment Program, has been an active bureaucrat in the United Nations from the early 1960s. He's a Canadian billionaire industrialist who, by the way, profited hugely from some scandalous behavior of his involved with the oil for food deal with Iran back in the 1990s. At any rate, or Iraq, I think. government as the issue that could justify going for global government instead of national government, undermining national sovereignty and instituting a global world government. So this is a clearly political issue, and of course all the various solutions proposed for dangerous man-made global warming require political action to reduce the use of one source of energy and replace it with another source of energy, to restrict the consumption of energy, all sorts of things. Like, all of these things are political. And so when the people, when the folks on the alarmist side say, oh, don't talk politics here, you have to just talk science, no. We have to talk science, we have to talk politics, we have to talk economics, we have to talk ethics, we have to talk about even, frankly, theology and philosophy. All of these things intertwine. And this is why the Cornwall Alliance is made up not just of natural scientists, though we do, in fact, have a great number of those, including climatologists and meteorologists, but also of economists and theologians, philosophers, and ethicists, so that we can bring the insights of all of these different intellectual fields of thought together for developing a well-balanced, a well-integrated understanding of what biblical earth stewardship really is, how we can best enhance the fruitfulness, the beauty, and the safety of the earth.
And it's important.
Well, great. Well, that's great. I find it also curious when I ask these people about the stupid talking point about global average temperature. I ask them, what is the perfect global average temperature? And they call it a straw man. Why do they do that?
Yeah, because, frankly, they don't have an answer to that. They're telling us that it's bad if the globe gets a little warmer, but they don't know what would be the optimal temperature of the world. Well, you know what? Historians of climate, such as Hubert Lamb, the founder of the Climate Research Unit at University of East Anglia, one of the greatest scholars in this field, refer to the warmest periods in Earth's history as climate optimum. For instance, the Holocene climate optimum. Why? Because all life thrives best when the Earth is warmest, not when it's coldest. Cold snaps, on average, kill 10 times as many people per day as heat waves. Cold results in smaller harvests. Warmth results in greater harvests. This is just basic knowledge for anybody familiar with the field, but they can't tell you a perfect temperature, an optimal temperature for the globe, precisely because there is none.
Climate, well, that's what I figured. You know, again, I'm not a scientist, but I do stump those people with that kind of question. Now, East Anglia, didn't Dr. David Viner say that children won't know what snow is anymore? But I think I see the snow falling up in Montana, but of course he doesn't live in Montana.
Yeah. And of course, that was just shortly before, this was a few years ago, that was shortly before Buffalo, New York had 104 inches of snow fall in a single blizzard.
And are you watching the Polar Ocean Challenge?
Pardon?
The Polar Ocean Challenge, the little sailboat that's flying around the Arctic?
Right. Yeah, and they thought they were going to be able to sail up to the North Pole, and they wound up having to be rescued, just like the other group that tried to get down to Antarctica for some research and had to be rescued from the ice there, because they thought that global warming was causing a diminishment of Antarctic sea ice, when in fact the exact opposite was happening. Sea ice in Antarctica was expanding at the very time that sea ice in the Arctic was contracting. And it turns out, actually, that there is an oscillation between those two.
Right.
As ice contracts in the north, it expands in the south, and vice versa.
Right. We're down to 18 seconds, guys. Kurt, I got to go.
Okay, well, thank you.
You betcha. Dr. Cal, I got about 12 seconds. Any last thought before we sign off for the day?
CornwallAlliance.org. CornwallAlliance.org, a place where people can learn far more about this.
Thanks so much. Thanks for knowledge and wisdom. God bless you, and we'll talk to you second Wednesday next month.
Great. Thank you, Terry.
You betcha. Bye-bye.